Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in American Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Lane, the host of the channel. It's common these days to hear young people being urged to collect and record the stories of their grandparents or parents in order to learn and preserve their family's history. For a few fortunate folks, like Robin Legere Henderson, such a record already exists. Henderson's maternal grandmother, Matilda Rabinowitz, penned her own memoir before her passing in 1963 so that her grandchildren would know her history. With candor and wit, Rabinowitz, who was born in 1887 in Ukraine, describes her experiences as an immigrant, factory worker, single mother by choice, and union organizer. In Immigrant Girl, Radical Woman, a memoir from the early 20th century, published by ILR Press in 2017, Henderson has expanded her grandmother's memoir with her own commentary and original black and white scratchboard drawings that illustrate Rabinowitz's early life, her journey to America, political awakening, work as an IWW organizer, her turbulent romance to Henderson's grandfather, and Rabinowitz's struggle to support herself and her child. To hear more about this unique collaboration across generations, listen to my interview with artist, curator, and author Robin Legere Henderson. Interested listeners can also learn more about Rabinowitz through an exhibit she'll be featured in at the Walter P. Reuther Library at Wayne State University in Detroit, where Rabinowitz once led a Studebaker strike. I'm thrilled to be talking today with Robin Legere Henderson, who published her grandmother Matilda Rabinowitz's memoir, Immigrant Girl, Radical Woman, a memoir from the early 20th century, with ILR Press, an imprint of Cornell University Press, in 2017. Robin, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Carrie. I'm really happy to be here.
Oh, and I'm happy to have you here. Could you begin by just telling us a little bit about yourself, where you were born, went to school, your life outside of this book?
Sure. I'm a California girl, born in Stockton, California, where my dad was a labor organizer, but soon moved to Los Angeles as a little kid, and that's where I grew up. Until I was 15 and I was wrenched out of my wonderful high school in Los Angeles, John Marshall High, and thrown into the wilds of upper middle class Fresno. And I just languished there for a long time. But I was lucky to graduate from high school there after two miserable years and go to Reed College in Portland, Oregon, where I spent 2 years deciding that I really wasn't an academic, and transferred to Berkeley, which was just on the cusp of starting of the beginnings of the free speech movement and all the wonderful, exciting times of the 1960s. So, and I majored in English literature, and then went back to Los Angeles for a couple of years after I graduated and taught elementary school. And then I decided I was going to be an artist because that was the only thing I could remember. Really, it was the only thing I did that would keep me up past bedtime, sometimes till 2 or 3 in the morning. drawing and painting. So I decided that that's what I should do. And so I went to art school at the San Francisco Art Institute for almost 2 years. And then kids, travels, kids, work. I worked for 20 years as a curator and the director of a couple of community art centers. The last one I worked for 20 years was the Berkeley Art Center in Berkeley, California, which is where I live now.
That's great. Well, now this interview is a bit unorthodox. I usually interview authors about books they have written. And in this case, the book we're discussing was initially written by your grandmother, Matilda Rabinowitz, and then it was expanded and illustrated and brought to publication by you. So could you also tell me a little bit about Matilda and her life?
I knew my grandmother. She was the only grandparent I really knew. Both my father's parents were dead. And my grandfather was way, way in the background. And maybe we can talk a little bit about that later on because he was an interesting character. But Matilda was my grandmother. So that's essentially how I knew her. But she was a very unusual grandmother. She was extremely verbal and intelligent and really, really involved in current events, politics, and just, you know, general world affairs. And I didn't realize anything about her past, except that I knew that she had been born in Russia, something that she would rarely discuss with us. We always questioned her about growing up in Russia, and she had very little to say about it. But as I grew older, I came to know that she was a labor organizer, during a very, very important time in labor history in this country. She was one of two female organizers for the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, and was the only other woman that was active at that time during the Wobblies' heyday. Where it was Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, who everybody's heard of, that studies labor history, but nobody knew about Matilda. So I think her experiences as an immigrant, as a worker in sweatshops, growing up working in sweatshops as a teenager, and then coming to this country as a kid and learning English, and then becoming politicized by her own personal history and the fact that she didn't get an education, which she really longed for, made her a very, very strong and forceful character, both as a grandmother and also as I came to learn later on in U.S. history.
And how did you come to first read her diary?
Well, It actually was a memoir that she wrote. So it was, she was also reflecting on her important events in her life. And she might have indicated that she was working on something. She wrote all the time. She was a good writer. And she wrote usually polemical stuff for labor publications like the Industrial Worker or the Socialist Newsletter or something like that. But I didn't know that she also was working on this memoir, probably when she was in her 60s, 50s or 60s, late in her life after she had retired. But after she died, among her papers, and there were some poems and some short stories and some other short things, was this longer document, and it was this memoir, and it covered the time of her earliest memories as a kid in Russia, and ended at about the time that she moved to California when my mother was about 5 years old. And it was just an extraordinary document, but it was funny at the time when my mother and I discovered it among her papers, and both of us thought, oh, this is so old-fashioned. It really needs to be updated, but it's a good story. And now, more recently, when I started really working on it, I realized, no, it sounds old-fashioned because she was born in 1887. Of course she wrote like a Victorian. And it's wonderful. It's very characteristic of writing of the time. So for years, and she died in 1963. So for years and years and years, I felt like this needs to be published, but it was only 100 pages. And I felt that it needed to be expanded, but I'm not a historian. I'm not an academic. I write, but I wrote a lot of art stuff, art criticisms and catalog essays and that sort of thing. But I'm not really equipped to write, to make a commentary on a historical document. And I thought, but I could do it as a personal thing, but that's not really enough. And for some reason, it took me until I retired to realize, well, my goodness, I'm an artist. I could illustrate it. And that's one of the things that I'm kind of sorry that this is a radio interview, because the audience can't see the illustrations, which I think really add to the texture of the work itself.
Well, and you know, my hope is actually that by listening to this interview, more people are going to find their way to the book itself so they can see those incredible drawings, because you're right. It certainly would be regretful if people heard Matilda's story without seeing the illustrations that I think you really bring to life, the memoir that she left. And it's interesting that you say it felt old fashioned to you, because I think what I was struck by, and we can talk about this in more detail later, what I was struck by again and again while reading this is how thoroughly modern Matilda is in so many ways. That, I mean, you could bring her right down to this minute in American culture, and she would have a lot to say about the current political moment. And I think she would still be, you know, characterized as sort of a progressive, forward-thinking woman, even in the 21st century.
I agree. And in fact, it's funny, I used to argue with her about, well, feminism was one thing that we would argue about. And I would say dismissive things to her, like, oh, Nana, women got the vote in 1920. Come on. And then, you know, what do you know? 10 years later, I'm in a women's consciousness raising group. And she was so right. And I was so silly. But I agree with you.
Interesting.
I think she is modern.
Well, she's modern, and she's also, you know, frankly, she's a real badass. I mean, I had very formidable grandmothers as well, but they were more formidable sort of within a sort of domestic sphere. And they weren't necessarily as politically engaged outside of their sort of family and close-knit community. And, you know, she was just, well, we'll go on and we'll talk about all the things that she was doing. But before we dig sort of more into the story of Matilda's life and the way the information she puts in her memoir, maybe you could tell me, when you started putting together the commentaries that you added to the memoir, how did you go about doing that? You've said you're not a historian, but it seems to me you clearly did a lot of researching so that you could add the context that would help readers make sense of what Matilda discusses in her memoir.
Yeah, that was very important to me. So I did do a lot of research. I did a lot of different kinds of research. First of all, I visited almost all the locations that she mentions in the memoir. And since I'm from the West Coast and have had very little time to explore the eastern part of the country, going to places like Nantucket for the first time, where my mother was born, or seeing New York, the Lower East Side of New York, and trying to imagine what it was like in 1900 when she arrived, going to Greenville, South Carolina, where she tried to organize cotton mill workers, and just being able to see the kind of light that's there and the older buildings, and go to some of the old mill villages gave me, and then I took the train from South Carolina to New York City. So I had the experience of actually traveling the way she might have traveled, although I did get a sleeper and I'm sure she sat in the coach car. That was part of it. The traveling was really important. But I also did a lot of research. I went to the archives. My mother placed Matilda's material, all of her archives, at at the Walter Reuther Library at Wayne State University in Detroit. And so I went there and I went through all the archives that they had all of her things there. And my grandfather's papers were also there. And so I looked at some of those. And then people that I knew, amateur historians and other people who were interested in this part of this era, got in touch with me because I put a few things out online about Matilda, trying to get more recognition for the accomplishments that she did. And people started sending me things. And then I started doing more online research, especially for imagery and pictures and that sort of thing. But the commentary, the actual written commentary for me was more difficult because it was hard for me to figure out what the voice should be and what tone I should take. And then I realized, well, she was my grandmother, and I did know her pretty well. I was 20 when she died. So I could just tell the story from a personal point of view and just be very straightforward about the voice, and it would work out fine.
Well, and I think it did. So one of the things I like to ask authors about when I interview them is what their writing process looks like. So when you sat down to write those commentaries, how did you do that? On paper, by computer? Did you write on perhaps, the manuscripts that Matilda had provided? What did that look like for you?
Well, I did have a copy of her entire manuscript, plus a lot of other documents. I had the entire archive from Wayne State, from the Reuther Library, which isn't very big. And so I had those documents to refer to. But mostly I write on the computer. I type pretty fast, and I find it's easier for me to write typing than even in longhand. And it was real slow going at first. And then after I started doing some more research and reading and rereading her manuscript and some of the other material that I was finding, it seemed to come a lot faster and a lot more easily. So that was, it was a very long process for me. I worked slowly, but it was pretty straightforward, sitting at my desk, pounding away at the computer. At the same time, I was doing the drawings. I mean, I was doing the drawings at the same time I was doing the writing. And I pretty much did them chronologically. I went through the manuscript page by page, and imagery that popped out for me, I would try to figure out. Either sometimes I had photographic images to work from. I had some family photographs and some that are in the archives at Wayne State that my mother donated. Those I could easily turn into drawings, but other things I had to do historical research. I had to, make sure the costumes were accurate, that the interiors looked like interiors of the time, that the street scenes looked like street scenes would have at the time that Matilda was writing about. So those kinds of things. So it was, a lot of computer, some libraries, and just flipping through manuscripts and photographs.
And the illustrations, how did you go about making those? What style for people who can't just flip the book open like I can on my desk right now? Can you tell me a little bit about the style of the illustrations?
Okay. The material I used was the medium is scratchboard, which is a chalky substance applied to a substrate, some kind of masonite type substrate, and then covered with India ink. And so to get the image, you scratch through the black to reveal the white that's underneath, and that provides the highlights and the negative spaces for the drawings. And the reason I like that, particularly for this project, but I had been using it for other things that I was doing too. But I liked it for this because it has the feeling of old block prints, like lino cuts or wood cuts, and because of the method that's used, which is removing the black to get the highlights and the whites. And I thought that it those. That technique and that medium really lent itself to kind of giving a feeling of the period that the work was set in.
That I definitely agree. And they go really nicely with Matilda's memoir. So let's turn then to Matilda's story and to the memoir that makes up sort of the body of the text. So the book begins with Matilda's childhood in Ukraine. Can you tell me about her early years?
Yeah, she was Jewish, and she was the first girl in her family, the first generation of girls in her family, to be formally educated. Her mother was illiterate and very devout, a wonderful homemaker, housewife, and also her family had a little inn, and that's what provided the livelihood for my grandmother's family. So my great-grandfather had been an orphan and had studied for the rabbinate, but he actually came from a family of harness makers. So they were, you know, they were petty craftsmen and they had, you know, and merchants. And Jews, of course, at that time were quite discriminated against in Eastern Europe. And there were, the family endured increasing hardship, so much so that my great-grandfather decided that he couldn't maintain his family there anymore. And he left to see if he could make a living in another part of the world. And he landed first in England and then on to the United States, where he, on and off, was a laborer for the rest of his life. It was a very typical kind of immigration story for so many people from Eastern Europe and also from Southern Europe at the time that my grandmother came over. So she did go to school. She was probably the equivalent of about the eighth grade when they left Russia. And her father had gone, as I said, 5 years earlier before the mother and Matilda's four siblings left. And I just imagine this woman who speaks no other language but Yiddish, cannot read or write, shepherding five children through Europe, the first time they'd ever been seen a train, let alone be on a train, and, you know, going all the way from the shtetl to Glasgow, Scotland, where they caught a boat for the U.S. It was quite a it was a typical journey, but it was an arduous one.
Well, and it you know, the story itself suggests that the strength that Matilda's mother must have had to undertake that journey with all of these children and her husband a continent away. But in Matilda's memoir, it's clear that her relationship with her mother was quite complicated. And I wondered if you could speak a bit to that.
Yes, it's quite clear, isn't it? She definitely was hit her daddy's girl. She really admired her father, and he was the impractical one, the dreamy one, the one who would prefer to read his paper and have a glass of tea or have discussions with his friends. And he was an atheist, and her mother was devout. And her mother really wanted for her daughter what she considered was the pinnacle of feminine achievement, which would be marriage to a hardworking man, not too much like her father, and lots of kids. And she wanted her to be a good housekeeper and a cook. And those were not things that Matilda had any interest in at all. She was interested in poetry, in history, in romance, in music, and in politics. And she wanted a different kind of life. She could imagine a different kind of life for herself. And so I think she and her mother were always at odds. I don't think her mother really understood what her daughter was up to or what she was about. And I don't think Matilda really understood or sympathized with the role that her mother had to play in her historical period. And I think that's the kind of struggle between mothers and daughters that's not uncommon.
I think you're definitely right. They probably had more in common than either one imagined.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
When Matilda was still quite young, I mean, she was about 14 when she, was in the U.S. and began earning money clipping threads at a shirtwaist factory during the day and attending school at night. So she worked 10 hours a day and a half day on Saturday for $2.50 a week. And so how did Matilda describe her work? What does she say about it?
Oh, man. Matilda was just the absolute quintessential Marxian when it came to the alienation of labor under capitalism. I mean, she thought it was the most boring, tedious, unpleasant work. And I think the thing that was really upsetting to her was how really boring it was, because you just did the same operation over and over and over again. Nothing was demanded of the worker in the way of intelligence or any kind of initiative. It was just, you were just a replacement for a machine, which now workers really are being almost entirely replaced by machines. So, I mean, she was, again, very progressive. She hated the work that she was doing and resented the fact that she couldn't be in school.
Well, and you know, she and you describe how she started to really grow more politically aware through her work and through other experiences. And she writes that it was the trial of Charles Moyer and Bill Haywood, leaders of the Western Federation of Miners. And she writes, I'm quoting here, that trial was the unfolding of labor's history and labor's struggle for me. And I followed every word, every nuance with avidity. It opened my road to socialism, never to be closed. End quote. So what do you think it was that drew Matilda to socialism? And what was it that kept her there?
Well, I think really the principles of socialism were things that she just could not dispute. She really, really believed in social democracy. And I think that socialism was in the air at that time, even especially in Europe, for where she originated. The socialist movements were gaining all kinds of momentum, and that it was also gaining momentum in the United States. So she was not just influenced by this one trial, but she was influenced by the people she was meeting, the fact that she was curious about, she attended plays, progressive plays, you know, the plays of progressive writers. She performed in an Ibsen play. She, you know, went to Susan Glass Bell plays. I mean, she was really involved in the youth culture of her time, which was tended toward socialism and anarchism and, you know, theories of liberation that we're beginning to see on the rise again, I hope. I think.
Well, you know, you talk about, or she talks about, sort of how these ideologies, you know, really inspired her and obviously connected with certain just inclinations she had intellectually or personally. And then she also got incredibly involved in the labor movement. And I wondered if you could tell me a little bit about her work as an organizer.
Yeah, she didn't set out to be an organizer. She just joined organizations. She was a member of the WTUL, the Women Trade Union League. And she joined the IWW. She joined the Socialist Party, and she was very active in the Socialist Party. And she was one of the few young women in the party that was very, very active. And she allied herself with the radical young socialists. And among them, and this is another fun part of her story, was my grandfather, Ben Legere. And I think she became very involved both personally and politically in this movement because it was so important and so exciting at the time. And so she felt so it would actually lead to changes that would make life better for all of the people who were in her position, workers.
Well, I definitely want to talk more about Matilda's work, but let's, you know, you sort of mentioned your grandfather. So let's talk about romance for a second. Your grandmother and grandfather had a very tumultuous on and off again affair for many, many years. So how did they meet and what was their relationship like?
Well, I guess that's why I mentioned it because it I think they met probably in 1910 when Matilda was working in a shirtwaist factory in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and Ben was living there too, and he was part of this young, the young socialists, the radical socialists, and he was an actor and very handsome, and he was married with two children, and he and Matilda both believed in free love, and so they decided to engage in it. But it was difficult because it was certainly not popular, and her parents were appalled. So then she after having this beginning of a romance with him in Bridgeport, she decided to escape the whole thing and go to Boston. And that's really when she sort of embarked on thinking that maybe she could do more than just clip threads in a shirtwaist factory or put stays into corsets in a corset factory, that she could maybe be more useful. And she, in Boston, she got a job with some educated women who were conducting government surveys on working conditions in factories and workplaces in Connecticut and Massachusetts. And Matilda was so adept at all the nuts and bolts of doing the work that she was asked to do, which were recording statistics on the one hand, but also translating because she spoke many languages, and just being a very, very quick study. And people were kind of amazed at her abilities. And so during that period, she felt like she should go to college. And she was being encouraged by some of her coworkers on the studies, the labor studies, to apply to college. But at the same time, Ben, her lover, had been sent to Little Falls by the IWW to organize a strike that had broken out there. And so he was, when he and his partner, Filippo Volchini, were thrown in jail, she was sent by the IWW to go and lead the strike for the IWW. And that was her introduction. And one of my favorite chapters in the whole book is her discussing her becoming an organizer for the first time. And I think that one of the marvelous things she does is she goes into great detail about all the nuts and bolts of all the daily tasks that were required of somebody who really wanted to conduct a successful strike. And in the meantime, my grandfather was in jail, He was not my grandfather yet, he was to become my grandfather. And they were sending letters back and forth, which were intercepted. So this was also Matilda's first introduction to a spy in the movement who took the letters and turned them over to the authorities, and they were published in the newspapers. And I think my grandfather adored having the stuff exposed in the press. But my grandmother, I think, was somewhat humiliated by being exposed. But their affair continued after he was out of jail. Well, before he was in prison for a year, and Matilda was on the stump trying to organize funds for his release and working for that. Although at the time she said she was finished with the relationship, but it was not to be. It continued for 10 years, on again, off again. And it's, I cannot figure out, even though I have read this stuff over and over again, I cannot imagine what it was that kept her coming back to somebody who was so unsuited.
Well, it's interesting because she writes about him with such sort of deep love, but also such an awareness of his shortcomings, right? I mean, she is not blind to the ways in which he is not the man that she would wish that he was, and the way in which he isn't really handling his responsibilities in different ways. And, you know, you write in the book, though Matilda and Ben were initially united by politics and love of literature, one can only guess that much of their attachment was erotic. Right. And it sounds like that's sort of you trying to figure out, why does she keep going back? But what's it like to write that about your grandparents?
It is kind of odd, isn't it? It's hard to imagine such a thing, really. I can only do it if I imagine them as characters in a movie or something like that, you know, not related to me. It's the only thing that makes sense to me for what would have kept this romance going over such a long period of time when, as you've already pointed out, she was so aware of his shortcomings and he was really rather exploitative and sometimes violent. And that really surprised me that she tolerated, you know, she kept welcoming him back after he would act with some violence. It must have been quite a passionate affection.
Well, and you know, of that affection, right, was born your mother, Vida, in 1918. And Matilda describes that time as one in which she was, quote, deliriously happy. But I just keep thinking about certainly, of course, there have always been single mothers, but it's interesting to think about a woman in 1918 becoming a single mother by choice, right? She decided to have a child with Ben. And I wondered if you could tell me a bit, what was it like for her to be a single mother at that time?
You know, that's something that's been very interesting to me throughout my life. My mother always knew that she was, as she would sometimes say caustically, a bastard. And then she would laugh. And if somebody, my father would sometimes, particularly when he was driving, say something like, "Oh, you bastard, get out of my way." And my mother would say, "I'm the only bastard around here." And so my mother, it was quite clear that, you know, her parents had not been married. But because of the milieu that Matilda traveled in, not her family, not her parents, not society in general, but the Socialist Party, the bohemians that she knew, the people on the left that were her friends and her colleagues and her coworkers, most of them were pretty much on the same page as she was about such things as she would say to me, marriage is a corrupt institution. And just in that tone of voice, she, you know, weathered it pretty well, although she used she called herself Mrs. Robbins, not Miss. And she allowed people to believe that she was either divorced or widowed, because otherwise it would have been more difficult for her to find work. And it was really, really necessary for her to find employment. And that was the most difficult thing about being a single mother, is having to take care of a child. And Matilda writes about it, and it's in the appendix of the book. And I think it's a wonderful essay, because it reminds me of my own experience at the same age.
Well, and I think it's really interesting to read Matilda writing about the challenges. And she writes in such sort of everyday detail about just trying to make the money stretch and figuring out how can she get childcare enough so that she can work here or work there. Where is she going to put Vita? And that tension she feels between wanting to work and also having to work to support herself and her child, and yet not wanting to be away from her daughter, but wanting her daughter to have these wonderful experiences outside of the city that she can't be there for. I mean, it just spoke so clearly to a contemporary moment as well. I think any parent who's working for pay while also being a primary caregiver reads that with, you know, sort of a lump in their throat. She's just trying to figure this all out.
Yeah. And you're right. I mean, she remembers detail in of such minutiae. I mean, she knows how much a loaf of bread costs, how much a gallon of or a quart of milk costs. She remembers every salary she was ever paid. I mean, I assume that her memory is accurate. I have no way of really checking it, but it certainly seems to be in line with what else I know about, you know, pay and so forth at that period. But it's funny that she can it was funny to me that she could remember everything with such minute detail. I agree with you that I think the strain and the stress of having to, especially, for example, when she would talk about a daycare worker wouldn't show up, the girl that was supposed to take care of Vita during the day wouldn't show up, and she had to be to work, and she had to be back by exactly, if she missed a train, she would not be back in time, and the caretaker might leave. Or, you know, if the child was sick, what did she do? You know, she had to be at work, but she also had to be with her child. It was, I mean, I went through the same thing. Nothing has changed. It's really depressing.
It's true. It's true. And we don't get this in the memoir, but what was it? What was your mother's experience of that like? How does she describe her childhood?
I think she had a good childhood. She felt that her mother spent too much time in the evenings at meetings. She really did not like her mom being away and leaving her alone in the house. She always wished she had siblings, and I think that's why she had four children herself. But she and Matilda were very, very close when Matilda was growing up. And sometimes when I read the letters that pass between them, where she's calling her mother's Madonna Mia, and you know, and Matilda also addressing Vita very tenderly, and they were extremely close, as you might imagine, being just a family of two people, and also, you know, Matilda being so involved in her political work and her jobs. But I think my mother certainly didn't feel any embarrassment about her own situation, being an only child of a single mother. I think my mother was somewhat of a rebel herself.
It would be hard to be Matilda Rabinowitz's daughter and not be a little bit of a rebel, I think. but, you know, it is interesting. I think probably that's a lesson, or not a lesson, but as I read the book, you know, there maybe have been moments where Matilda hid the fact that, you know, that Vita was born out of wedlock for pragmatic reasons, right? Going by misses or letting people assume what they wanted to assume about mm-hmm. her situation. But there's no shame whatsoever.
Oh, in the book. Absolutely
there's
not.
There's clearly no shame, no regret at all.
No. That's right. She really was principled. I mean, that was one of the things that is so outstanding to me about her personally. She was incredibly principled, and she was always, I mean, and she, the principles maintained from the beginning, she didn't change. The principles that she adopted as a young woman were the principles that she still adhered to on her deathbed. I mean, she really, really was extremely honorable and principled. And she, you know, if she believed something, she acted upon it, and she had no regrets.
Well, and one of the things I think that the details she provides in her book, the way in which she stood by her principles often brought her into conflict with other members of the labor movement or the Socialist Party. And that was actually one of the most challenging parts for me in reading the book, was that at least when I was reading Matilda's memoir, I found it hard sometimes to follow those internal struggles and debates within the labor movement, partly because even though I've taught about this era and read about this era, it tends to be broader strokes, right? Sort of the labor movement, as opposed to these really internecine debates within it and disagreements. And I found it hard to follow it sometimes, you know, why she was disagreeing with someone or how her views differed so strongly from someone else, from a different organizer or a different labor leader. And I wondered, how did you go about making sense of those? Because your commentaries really helped me to understand the things she had written. So how did you go about making sense of that as you were reading her memoir?
Well, I think I really did. I mean, Matilda and I had many, many discussions throughout, from the time I was a little girl, because I was interested in history and I was interested in the labor movement, and I followed politics of my time. And if so, we would have lots and lots of discussions. So I knew what her point of view was. I mean, I knew why she didn't like, you know, the craft unions. I knew why she was, you know, sort of opposed to the AFL-CIO, because she would complain about them all the time. She despised the politics of the Kennedy administration. Because she believed, as a Wobbly would, in industrial labor. She thought all politics should start in the workplace. I mean, I just understood these things because I knew her and because we talked about them. And then, of course, as I read, I began to see some of the more nuanced things. But a lot of it, because I knew exactly how she thought, or not exactly, I can't say I knew exactly how she thought, but I knew how she thought politically, because we had so many discussions over the years. And she disagreed with my parents on things too. I mean, I would talk to my parents and I would talk to her. So it sort of helped me, you know, kind of see how, and we're still doing it. The left is still doing it to itself. It's still destroying itself by, you know, internal arguments.
Well, it's interesting to me though that, you know, I mean, Matilda clearly had strong opinions about these things throughout her life, I'm sure till her final days. But she ends the memoir, it seems to me, somewhat early in her life. She stops writing. And so I wondered if you could tell us, sort of, you know, where is Matilda in her life when she ends that memoir?
She was right at the midpoint, the chronological midpoint of her life. And I think that she ends it there because she considered it the most exciting part of her life. It was the story she had to tell. The rest of the story would have been probably very confusing and not very interesting, because it would be a lot like what you were just talking about, you know, internecine battles of, you know, who thought this and why they were wrong, that sort of thing. But the early stuff, the first half of her life, I think she considered to be, you know, the exciting, the thrilling, the most interesting and important part of her life. Because when she became a parent, and because her daughter was really the center of her life, she moved to Los Angeles. She was probably 36 or 37 years old. She put Vita in progressive schools, the UCLA training school my mother went to, and then she went to a private school in San Diego run by a communist. But she had to work, and she her politics were very much, you know, evening meetings and Saturday afternoon gatherings and that sort of thing. She worked first when she came to California. She worked as she taught herself shorthand and typing, so she became a secretary and she could do take dictation for people. So she worked for business people and but then she got a lucky break and she got a job as a social worker at a Jewish welfare agency in Southern California, and she was there for many years. And almost as soon as she arrived on the scene, she decided that she would organize her fellow workers, her fellow social workers at this agency. So she was still active. And she was a member of the Socialist Party in Los Angeles. Sometimes she would leave because she would disagree with the direction that the party was going in. And then she would come back. But she organized the Debs Centennial in Los Angeles in the 50s, and she was a secretary of the Socialist Party in Los Angeles for several years. So she was, you know, she was still very active and wrote. She continued to write articles, polemics. So that's how late in her life, my parents moved to Fresno. I think I mentioned that early on, and Matilda was very lonely without her family. She was attached to all of us. And so she moved to Fresno, and that did not work out well. She didn't have that many friends in Fresno. It was hard to make new friends at her age. And so when I came to Berkeley to go to school at Cal, she decided that she would move to Berkeley. So the last 2 years of her life, she lived in Berkeley while I was in school here, and I saw her a couple of times a week, and she was really included in my life. Our friends loved her. My roommates thought she was amazing. And so sometimes I would drop by and see her in the afternoon on my way home from school. And sometimes I would bring friends with me, and she would always engage them in discussions. And I remember them talking about C. Wright Mills. And I mean, my grandmother just kept au courant of what was going on in the news, in politics all the time. And old socialists and old wobblies found out that she was in Berkeley, and they would seek her out and come to visit her. So she acquired quite a circle of people who, you know, were friends of hers. And I think I'm so happy that I was able to share those last couple of years with her, even though I was, you know, pretty absorbed in my own issues of being a student and young and trying to sow a few wild oats of my own.
Well, I mean, you've given our listeners a great sense of Matilda's story, which is just an incredible one. And, you know, I really hope that people go and read the book, because you really have to read her words and see the drawings that you've created to go along with them to get the full impact of her personality. And you really do feel like you know her somewhat by the time you finish this book. And I wondered, when you were putting the book together, what was the hardest part for you?
You know, I think the hardest part for me was actually getting somebody to take a look at it and consider it for publication. I felt I had a good story. I felt I had some decent drawings. I felt I could, you know, that it was a worthy work. And I thought that it was a story that people would want to read and would be interested in, and that it would add to the history of our, you know, I mean, we didn't talk very much about this, but she's been really embraced by the Jewish community, because she's kind of an icon of sort of Jewish women, progressive Jewish women. And she's also a really such a strong feminist. And then, you know, she organized strikes in Detroit, in Ohio, in Pennsylvania. She went to jail several times. I mean, it's really quite a full story, but getting somebody to actually look at it and consider it for publication was really, I was so lucky. If I hadn't known somebody who knew Fran, I probably would not have ever gotten anybody. I actually asked Fran Benson this. I said, if I just tossed it over the transom, I bet you never would have looked at it. And she said, I think you're probably right.
And this is Fran Benson at ILR Press, who ultimately ended up publishing the book.
That's right.
So you had a friend in common who brought the manuscript to her?
I had a friend who had a friend of who was a friend of hers. I had a friend who is a sociologist at Stony Brook, and he was friends with also a sociologist who was a good friend of Fran's. And the friend, you know, presented the work to his friend, and she presented it to Fran. And Fran said she thought she was going to have it was going to be a hard sell because, you know, this kind of book is not going to be a bestseller, or, you know, probably. But she really, once she decided to take the project on, she really did a magnificent job. I think she created a beautiful book, and it wouldn't have been so nice without her.
Yeah, I think so as well. I think it's come together in a beautiful way. But that was the hardest part. What was the most fun for you?
Oh, doing the drawings. Absolutely doing the drawings. I mean, I had such a good time doing the finding an image that would work and then trying to figure out. I love to draw. And so, of course, you know, that's what kept me going was, you know, just thinking up new drawings. And even after I finished the project, I would go back and I would say, oh, I don't like that drawing so much. I think I'll do a better one. And it's not in the book, but I have a better drawing.
Well, you said, I mean, that's what drew you to it in the first place, right? It was the one thing you'd stay up late to do. So yeah. that remains. If readers take home only one thing from this book, what would you want it to be?
Oh, my. I would like them to understand how complicated and nuanced a life that's dedicated to principle can be, and how brave one small person can be in actually creating some kind of social and economic progress. I don't know. That's kind of general, but I mean, I really do think Matilda is a heroic figure, and I guess that's what I'd like people to remember.
Yeah, I don't think that's general at all. I think that's, you know, right at the heart of it, and also right at the heart of why this book, even for someone who's not necessarily interested in the history of the early 20th century, the book speaks to more than that, right? In terms of how one makes social change, like you said, what does it mean to live a principled life? Right. And also just as a biography of a really fascinating person who lived a complicated life, as you said. And I, you know, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me about the book. And I know that our listeners will too. But before I let you go, what are you working on now? I know you continue to work as an artist and curator. So what's next for you?
Well, I'm probably going to try something a little bit more contemporary. I'm working on something that's more like, the French call it bande dessinée, more like a graphic novel or a comic book even. And I got my father's FBI file recently. And so that's going to figure prominently in the story. And it's going to be more drawings than Immigrant Girl, Radical Woman. And more like, it'll be more like a graphic novel or a comic book.
Oh, I will read that book. I'm also impressed that your dad has an FBI file. I don't think mine does.
it's not very exciting. I mean, they didn't find out much, but it sure goes on for a long time.
Well, I will look forward to that one when it comes out as well. So thank you again, Robin. I really appreciate your talking with me.
Oh, I really enjoyed our discussion too. Thank you for inviting me.